this time on your weekly Constitutional.
I'm interested in Battison for his core principles and in his wheelhouse, which is constitutional design. I'm interested in what he thought about human nature and how his conceptions of human nature informed his understanding of constitutional design, and also how they are underpinned by certain ethical propositions that he had as well.
That was Alan Gibson, who teaches at California State University at Chico. What an interesting question. What did James Madison think about human nature? He knew that we're not angels, but what did he think of us? I'm Stuart Harris, and this week, it's about Madison, human nature, and constitutional design.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. So wrote James Madison in Federalist Number 51. But those are negative statements. Madison was telling us, well, what we already know, that we're not perfect beings. But if we're not perfect beings, then what are we? How are we imperfect? How should those imperfections be taken into account when we decide how we're going to govern ourselves? What an interesting question. And it's one that's very much on the mind of Alan Gibson, who teaches at California State University at Chico. I met Alan at a recent conference on James Madison held at his home, Montpelier.
I'm a Madisonian scholar, a scholar of constitutional history, and also a political science.
Chico. Uh-huh. Chico. Where is Chico?
Chico is about 90 miles north of Sacramento.
It's sort of north central California?
Yes. It's about 4 hours from the Oregon border going north on Interstate 5. And then you're about, about 80, 90 miles from Sacramento.
That's pretty far west of here. Does the Constitution apply all the way out in Chico?
It does apply.
It does apply. Okay.
It does. They have probably a much different view of it than you do in Virginia, but it applies to both places.
Glad to hear it. Okay. So now we know where Chico is, and we know that you're a Madison scholar, and you were about to tell me what sort of things you were interested in, what sort of things we might talk about.
Well, I'm interested in Madison, for his core principles and in his wheelhouse, which is constitutional design. I'm interested in what he thought about human nature and how his conceptions of human nature informed his understanding of constitutional design, and also how they are underpinned by certain ethical propositions that he had as well. And I'm interested in Madison's whole political career, but I'm mostly centered during the period that most people study, which is his service in the Confederation Congress all the way up until he is an opposition leader in the House of Representatives. So the years are the inclusive years are roughly 1780 to 1792. I'm interested in Madison outside of that window, but that's sort of the era that most people who are Madison scholars look at Madison at, because they're interested, again, in him as father of the Constitution.
Sure. Now, that's a really interesting thing, and it makes a great deal of sense because, of course, constitutions are about government, and government is about people. And so starting from human nature is a very logical starting point. Now, the only quote I'm aware of about Madison and human nature is the famous one regarding angels. What was that one?
Something like, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, it would be a whole lot easier, I think.
It certainly would be.
But
we're not angels, are we? That was Federalist 10, was it?
No, that's 51.
It was either 10 or 51. I had a 50-50 chance there. Okay. Federalist 51.
Yeah, that's the most quoted phrase. Of course, I didn't quote it after the first part there. But that's the phrase from which he's known most for. He says a lot of things about human nature in the Federalist Papers when he's assuming the voice of Publius. Mm-hmm. He says a lot in his private papers as well. He is constantly musing on the concept of human nature. He has an interestingly gray understanding of human nature in my estimation. So there's a couple different tensions. And if you want to understand Madison, I think you have to understand a very, very complex mind at work. working with tension in between the ideas that he holds, with an understanding that there are a multiplicity of purposes for which a government should serve and a multiplicity of tendencies, and that those things have to be held in tension with each other. And so with regard, you know, at a meta level, with regard to his understanding of human nature, he understands that Republican governments predispose a certain amount of virtue in people, that you have freedom, you're granting freedom to people, you're giving them power of self-government. Liberty is at center. He's very famous for saying that America has created charters which guarantee liberty rather than having charters that are predominantly concerned with power and from which liberty is an exception. So our charters guarantee liberty first, and other charters guarantee power first is one of his was one of his big points in one of
so
his,
one of his to restate it then one of the premises of a Republican form of government is that there is some good in human nature. There's, otherwise, it would make no sense to give people liberty.
That's right.
So that's the good part then of Madison's conception of human nature.
So just to elaborate just a little bit more on that, he does not have a Hobbesian conception of human nature. So Hobbes is the famous 17th century English philosopher of the Leviathan,
right,
who said that without government in place in the state of nature, life is solitary, nasty, brutish, and short.
Right.
This is the very famous famous quote. So you need a Leviathan to control things. Madison,
I sometimes tell my students that Hobbes was describing me, nasty, brutish, and short.
Are you solitary also?
Not solitary. We cut that. A lot of people will cut that word out. I don't know exactly why, but you're right. That's a very negative view of what happens when it's sort of a Lord of the Flies perspective.
So Madison says in the Federalist Papers that if that likeness of human nature were true, and he attributes to the Anti-Federalist incident, interestingly enough, then you would need the chains of despotism, he says, mm-hmm, in order to control people. But obviously, they're not setting up the chains of despotism in the Constitution. They are setting up something quite different from that. And so he also believes, though, that government requires power to be exercised on people. He does not consider the Articles of Confederation government even to be a real government, what he calls a political constitution, a real government, a political constitution. He considers it a system of states who are brought into an alliance with each other. And so the quality lacking in the Articles of Confederation is a coercive power. If you remember the Articles of Confederation, there is no power to coerce taxation or a power to have commercial regulation, and the two are very related to each other. And you raised money by regulating commerce, especially international commerce, mm-hmm, during this time period. That was the principal way that they knew that they were going to get money for the government, was land sales and impost duties on imports.
In fact, I read someplace that prior to Prohibition, the number one source of the federal budget each year was whiskey tax or on distilled spirits. Yeah, and okay, again, that relates to the Whiskey Rebellion and all the rest of that stuff. So, yeah.
So, at any rate, Madison believes that it's a necessary product of government, that it is going to exercise power and that it's going to limit people's liberty. And so he has a view of human nature that we simply can't depend upon our mutual associations with each other, our free associations with each other, to prevent either tyranny from resulting from the rule of one or a few, or an even greater threat to him in 1787, and that's majority tyranny. So Madison's one of three principal thinkers that I can think about right off the top of my head who focus, and again, this is in the period about in the mid-1780s, who think of the tyranny of the majority as the principal threat to liberty. And the reason that is the case for Madison is that you have granted power to the people. They, mm-hmm, are the sovereign. And so you have to check power where power is lodged. And so for Madison, and it is a principle of Republican government that the majority ultimately rules in such a government. Okay? You have a sovereign people, and they are then going to have ultimate control over the government and its policies, even though you have a very complex governmental system set up to regulate, to filter. You extend the spirit of the republic to moderate those majorities. There are a number of different things that are, the constitutional system does, but that's where your central source of threats to liberty is going to lie.
Isn't that interesting? You know, I just was recently making public presentation. I think it was primarily about gerrymandering. But we got into a theoretical discussion about democracy, and a point that was made repeatedly during that discussion was, I think it was with the League of Women Voters in Abingdon, Virginia, was that we tend to lionize democracy, the term. You know, defense of democracy, making the world safe for democracy, and even though it's a bit of a misnomer since we're really a republic. But nonetheless, we tend to worship that ideal, and as you've just pointed out, democracy does not necessarily mean liberty, because a majority of 50% plus one can impose all sorts of draconian measures on the remaining 49%. And perhaps would, unless it were in some fashion checked. And so much of what Madison did was to try to put checks on that power.
He points out in a very famous letter to Thomas Jefferson that concerns the Bill of Rights that one of the reasons that you he has argued up until this point, he's about to switch and become the father of the Bill of Rights also, but he's argued up until this point that Bills of Rights are not necessary in Republican governments, can even be counterproductive, because if you write the rights down, the list is necessarily going to be incomplete, and the government will actually end up assuming power in an area where it has no right to exercise power. It's kind of paradox. This is a very common argument among the Federalist people who proposed and championed the Constitution. In that very famous letter, Madison says it doesn't matter whether it's a powerful prince or a powerful party, that your liberty can be threatened from either of those sides. And he clearly believes that liberty is best protected towards some mean. And if you'll remember, again, go back to the 51st Federalist, what do you have to do? You have to control the government and the governed. You have to control both of them. But the sovereign people, the people are sovereign, but then they're going to create public, they're going to elect public officials, we're going to have a government. That government's going to be administered by people. It's not going to be administered by all of the people, but a few of them selected for that purpose. So you have to control them also. So the question of constitutional design is one of how best to control the governed and the government in such a way as to create liberty and to create that tension and the mean that you're looking for between power and liberty.
Let me then sum up, and you correct me if I'm wrong. Madison recognizes that people have both virtue and vice in them, and that's necessarily then what sort of government we have to have. We have to have a government that is majoritarian, that will give the maximum amount of power to people in one sense because they do have virtues. But then they have vices as well, and therefore we have to have checks on that power in some fashion.
I think that's a nice summation of what I've said so far and what he believes. I think he understands that the delegation of power to a few is a necessary proposition, especially in a country with a large population. That's part of what is being said in the 10th Federalist Paper and in other places. So he's one of the first champions of the idea that you don't need a pure democracy, you need a republic, and that's going to involve the delegation of power to a relatively few number, at least by percentage, of the people in your society. But they're going to be doing the bidding of the majority, but they're also going to be doing some other things in terms of trying to restrain the majority for certain kinds of tendencies. We're going to have absolute prohibitions on what the majority can do in some instances. We're going to have hopefully the best people elected to office in other areas. He has a scheme for elections from expanded electoral districts. He believes that is the primary mechanism for getting the most virtuous people into office. He believes.
Let's talk about that a little bit. Expanded electoral districts. What do you mean by that?
Well, at the time period, there are about approximately 1,600 to 2,000 state legislatures in all of the states combined. And in the mid-1780s, that's during the mid-1780s. So if you take each state legislature and you count the number, it varies over years, but it's somewhere between 1,600 and 2,000. Under the first Constitution, there are going to be 65 members of the House of Representatives. Now, they're going to increase in number immediately with each census, and there's a plan for doing that. But you can see that if you elect, say, 242, I think it's 242 from North Carolina state legislatures, but you only elect 65 from the whole nation of 3 million people, that the size of the district in which they're elected for is going to be much greater for the national office than it's going to be for the state office.
And Madison liked that.
He liked that. He considered it a filtration or a distillation of talent. That's what he called these principles. He speaks in the 10th Federalist paper of this as a mechanism for passing through the median of these superior and virtuous representatives, the public views. He's going to refine public opinion. One of my former professors, Gary Wills, was big on this idea, and since we talked about it at lunch a little bit, of distillation as the metaphor that's being talked about here.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about James Madison and his views on human nature. I'm speaking with Alan Gibson, who teaches at California State University at Chico. Stick around. And now let's continue our conversation with Alan Gibson, a professor at California State University at Chico, a Madison scholar who's interested in James Madison's view of human nature and how it affected Madison's constitutional design. It turns out that Madison's views on this subject even influenced how big he thought a geographic region should be when it elects a representative to Congress.
So if you have a big enough electoral district, then in theory at least, there are a fair number of talented people within that district, and the wisdom of the majority, with the various factions set against each other and no one faction being preeminent, will then reach some sort of compromise, one hopes, on one of the best people within that district.
Yes. He certainly believes that candidates of lesser lights are going to cancel each other out. So that's part of the dynamic you're talking about. But he also believes that the most prominent people in that particular district will draw the attention of the voters to them. He talks about the attractive principle, virtually. They're going to have an attraction. The voters are going to have an attraction to people of a great reputation.
This was clearly before the advent of reality television.
Well, this is one of the things that when I teach this that I talk to my students about. The underlying premise of all of this is that merit and notoriety of character are in the same person. And so that if you are known, widely known, that you will be also virtuous. And of course—
Like Kim Kardashian.
This is the whole point of mentioning this, is the fundamental difference between our assumptions and Madison's assumptions. So for Madison, who's the biggest celebrity in the early Republic? It's George Washington, right? Mm-hmm. So he's the quintessential guy that he's talking about in terms of who might draw the attraction of voters. Demagogues are a problem. And this was seen as a problem of his scheme of using expanded electoral districts to filter the best representatives out. By Hamilton at the Constitutional Convention, Hamilton says demagogues are not inconsiderable men. They have reputations, too. So you got to worry
Napoleon,
about that.
For example.
You have to worry about them as well. Mm-hmm. And Madison was very worried about the advent of demagogues during this time period. He was particularly worried about it in the future when there became a time when there would be people who did not own property, who did not have land. And so there would be a time when we, you know, basically ran out of the possibility of having the independent proprietor, the independent yeoman. And commercialization would create that problem. And
so he tethered civic virtue to land ownership.
To a certain degree, too. It was not, though, that he was this is a kind of Charles Beardian progressive argument, that he was just trying to protect property. He wasn't just trying to protect property. Property was an indicator that you were a person of prominence. It was one of the staple things. Reputation and property went together and
made you respectable.
They were part of what it meant to be a gentleman. Mm-hmm. But reciprocally, what it meant to be a gentleman from the perspective of the representative who is the gentleman and representative who's elected is that they be impartial or disinterested in some way, that they not try to use the public funds for their own benefit. Now, so all of this is what one historian named Gordon Wood, Pulitzer Prize winning historian, talks about, the difference between the rhetoric and the reality. So were these guys self-interested? Yes, certainly, to a certain degree, and in a certain way. But they worked off of a gentlemanly code of impartiality or disinterestedness as well. So that was very, very important to them. I began the book that I'm writing on Madison by talking about a deal that Jefferson and Madison struck in buying a horse. Sounds like a perfectly innocuous kind of exchange, and they were friends by this time and that sort of thing. But Madison lent Jefferson a horse. The horse didn't know know that they had done this, and he performed well on the first trip that Jefferson took him on, and then he promptly died. And so what do you do when that happens? Your friends, what level of compensation? The compensation had not taken place yet for the horse, is my understanding. And so what do you do? How do you go about this problem? Well, what Madison suggested and Jefferson initially suggested was that they go to a third party. They get an impartial third party, an arbiter, to decide what the value was. So they perfectly trust each other and they're friends, but they nevertheless go to the principle of arbitration in order to decide this value. Why? Because no man is the proper judge in his own cause. You shouldn't be a judge in your own cause. And so this is one of the great principles of the Anglo-Saxon legal system of, that we've inherited from England. And this is the supposition that if you act in your own cause, then you're going to end up corrupting yourself. So systematically, the constitutional structure is also designed to prevent individuals from acting in their own causes in a number of different ways. Mm-hmm. Madison wants to have that implemented through constitutional design. He also wants to have that implemented through rules in Congress. He's on the committee that establishes the rules for the first Congress. He's on both that committee for the congressman and for the future Secretary of Treasury. Of course, it's going to be Alexander Hamilton. And in both cases, he argues for a rule and gets it passed. The rule is put in place. He's on the committee. We don't have him actually saying that he's for this, but I know he's behind it. Mm-hmm. At any rate, it basically says that you cannot engage passing a policy in which you are directly interested in the value of it. So can you think of anything that's more distant from our current system than that, or would be a better inoculation of our system than putting that into place?
Again, we're nonpartisan on this show, and which is an educational show, so I don't want people to think I'm particularly picking on someone, but we do happen to have a couple of issues with our current president, and one of them is the assertion that perhaps his pardon power is absolute. He could even go so far as to pardon his own family members or himself. How do you think Madison would react to that?
Well, I mean, I think that the axiom itself is self-evidently, the reaction is, the answer to that question is self-evident once you understand the proposition. You shouldn't be a judge in your own cause. You shouldn't be able to exercise this party over this power over family. Madison would have a problem not simply with all of that. He would have a problem with the appointment of family members inside the cabinet or inside your government system with large amounts of power. Anyway, they become judges in your own cause, particularly. So,
And to be fair about this, I mean, we've seen that sort of nepotism before, notably when John F. Kennedy appointed his brother Bobby to be Attorney General. Right. Talk about putting someone in a position to judge the legality of some of your actions. So there was a problem there as well. Of course, there's also a current controversy, and I think we're going to do a whole episode on this in the future, on the Emoluments Clause. In lay terms, basically, that means the president's not supposed to, or federal officials of any sort, are not supposed to accept compensation from foreign powers, simply because of the office that they hold, and that's a corrupting influence. And more generally, are not supposed to act in ways that are going to inure to their benefit in some fashion. So we've had some discussion about whether our current president is violating that clause. And then beyond that, with the current tax bill that's being discussed in December of 2017, there's concern that the president, who has many business holdings that have not been put into a blind trust, may be acting in a fashion that will benefit himself and his family. Any thoughts on that?
Again, these are things that would be strictly forbidden in a Madisonian system as he would have enacted it. Mm-hmm. So the Emoluments Clause, he's definitely for this, and he is a part of the discussion, if I remember correctly, about its adoption. It certainly is one of those things that are seen as being prohibited because they would corrupt and make biased the individuals who accepted the gift. if you mm-hmm. have someone who's a pipeline to money, you're not obviously you're going to be corrupted by your decisions that you're going to make in these areas. The Emoluments Clause is one of them. Madison was also concerned about representatives inhabiting offices that they themselves created while they were in office. Mm-hmm. So I'm elected to office, then I create an office while I'm in office that's unfilled at the time period. I resign, and then I go to that office. Made it a lucrative deal for myself. But I told you that there were sort of tensions in Madison's thoughts on all these things. He's also worried at this time period about the absence of good officials in government going back to the earliest days in the Confederation Congress. He believes that the people who served in Confederation Congress, he's actually a really young guy, and he's first getting ready to assume his appointment in the Confederation Congress, and he's railing on the quality of individuals who have taken these national positions. Mm-hmm. The state governments, incidentally, then are more prestigious anyway than the Confederation Congress.
That's why you never hear about the Confederation Congress. In fact, for those who are wondering what the heck we're talking about, of course, people have heard of the First and Second Continental Congresses.
Right.
It was the second such Congress that declared independence. But then during the Revolutionary War, we did adopt these Articles of Confederation. I believe they were finally approved in 1781. And at that point, we're now a confederation, and so formerly the Continental Congress becomes the Confederation Congress. And as you pointed out, especially after the war was over and the national emergency was over, power was really in the state governments, and it was a bunch of people that most of us have never heard of who served in the Confederation Congress. So that's what Madison was railing against.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's that. I mean, there are some pretty prestigious people in the Confederation Congress, and many of the people in Confederation Congress, of course, go on to the Constitutional Convention.
Right.
And there is a scheme of rotation of office in this time period as well. You can mm-hmm. only serve 3 out of 6 years. Mm-hmm. That tends to have a disinclination to people, using the office for ambition, which is why many people want it. But the tension that I mentioned with regard to creating an office and then inhabiting that office is that Madison wants there to be enough incentive for people to come to public office. He wants there to be salaries for those public officials, then they be stable. He doesn't want people working for free. He's a professional politician. And incidentally, let's return to that in a minute about the professional politician idea, because people rail on that in a way that I think is inappropriate today. But anyway, Before we go on, though,
I think that there's a strong, strong argument, and many people have made it. It's not original with me, that not only should you pay your elected officials and other officials, you should pay them well. And there are a couple of reasons for that. Otherwise, you will end up with only rich people serving, because they're the only ones who can afford to. And secondly, you'll open the door to a temptation for bribery. If I'm a congressman and I'm making significantly less money than I could make in the private sector, it'll be very tempting for me to accept emoluments or bribes or other forms of compensation, trips to the golf outing or that sort of thing, because I can't afford them on my own. I've never been a person who's resented paying congressmen or senators well. I think they should be paid well. So perhaps Madison would have agreed with that sentiment.
It's that's a somewhat harder call. It just involves, application of a more abstract principle to a particular fact situation.
Mm-hmm.
But he certainly wants a professional in the office, and I make the argument.
Yeah, I want good people. Yeah, I mean, I want good people, and good people, by and large, not always, but by and large, good people in the private sector could make a great deal of money. Because they're talented, because they're educated, because they're knowledgeable. And how do you expect to get good people to come and work for you in Congress if you're not paying them well?
You sound like me when I'm talking to my classes. It's exactly the kinds of arguments I make, that these people can make all kinds of money. My students sometimes naively gasp when they find out that representatives make around $200,000. I think they make like $175,000, $174,000 now,
right.
Unless you're Speaker of the House or you're a Senate Majority Leader. And then Supreme Court justices make around the same amount with the and the President now makes, what, $300,000 a year or something like that, $250,000 to $300,000.
Significant amount. I think it went up significantly recently.
But it did. At any rate,
but compare that to what a CEO would make of a corporation.
That's
you're paying the CEO of some hedge fund
hundreds of millions of dollars? I don't know. Tens of millions of dollars in a given year, certainly. And they're running enterprises that are significantly smaller, in many respects, less important than the government of the United States. So again, I don't mind paying people well.
That's exactly where I was going with the argument. That's exactly
it's a,
where
it's
I
a minuscule amount of the federal budget.
Again, but it's your point also, and I think it's the right point, is that it's peanuts compared to what they can make.
Yeah.
And so you don't and you don't want them to use the office itself for, as the vehicle for that. So if you provide a reasonable amount of pay, then that somewhat mitigates against the sting of just simple public service.
Right.
If taking public service means a pay cut.
Right.
And, it ought to for the people we're willing to elect. We should elect the best people, the smartest people in our society, and those people should be the ones who are able to achieve the most money. There is a kind of ethos, though, and I find that I get kind of people try to take me down when I make the arguments that we're making, we're both agreeing about, and I use Madison as somewhat the vehicle for doing that. And that takedown is that there's just this common sense kind of American out there. And that person, that ordinary person is better than this professional politician, and the professional politician is corrupt. I think it's the easiest thing in the world for us as Americans to foist corruption onto our legislative bodies, or to foist, to blame for corruption onto our legislative bodies and onto our people we elect to office, rather than look at ourselves hard in the mirror and say, did we somehow enable or facilitate that corruption? And actually, I'm a big believer that most of the things that Congress does right now that are corrupt, they're doing pretty much in the bidding of either a majority of us or the wealthy of us, among us. And so if we want to change the system and not blame politicians, well, if we don't want to blame politicians, we have to change the system. We have to put in place rules that prevent them from acting corruptly and those kinds of things. And I think in an abstract way, that's also what Madison is for. He says that no person should be a judge in their own cause, because that will his bias will influence his decisions and corrupt his integrity.
Mm-hmm.
So the absence of certain kinds of rules, the presence of a poorly constructed constitutional design, can encourage and facilitate corruption. And this is one of the things that I think it's so easy. It's just like a lawyer joke. A politician joke will get a laugh every time.
Right.
People ought to actually be, they ought to shadow a politician for some day. Shadow their congressmen,
their
senators.
They work hard. They do. And when you do that, when you denigrate an entire field, then you discourage good people from going into it.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Alan Gibson this week. He teaches at California State University at Chico, all about James Madison and the founding and the Constitution. And we're talking today about James Madison's thoughts on human nature. Stick around. And now let's finish our conversation with Alan Gibson of California State University at Chico. We're discussing James Madison's feelings about human nature, how it might have affected his design of the Constitution. And we were talking just before the break about how people like to denigrate politicians generally, and maybe they shouldn't do so.
20-some-odd years ago, I ran unsuccessfully for local public office. And the instant I declared my interest in becoming an elected official, people began to treat me differently. Oh, you're in it for yourself.
Yeah.
Oh, you're one of those guys. You're involved in public affairs simply because you want that paycheck. And believe me, it was not a particularly generous paycheck. No, certainly I needed the paycheck. I'm not wealthy. I needed to make a living. But what struck me was how instantly I was transformed in people's eyes, because by throwing my hat in the ring, I was now corrupt. Great. Well, are you going to encourage good people to run for office then? Of course not. And you mentioned before Madison as a career politician. I suspect I know then how he would have felt about term limits. I mean, he was a career politician. In fact, many of our founders were career politicians. That was the only job many of them had for much of their lives. Why? Because it is a career. Because it is something that takes practice and time and knowledge to do. And when you keep sending people in there who don't know what they're doing, there's a steep learning curve. And there's all sorts of opportunities, again, for corrupting outside influences to effectively control the body.
Madison was for longer terms of office than we currently have. He was for 3-year terms for representatives, and I believe even 9-year terms for senators or 11-year terms for senators. So mm-hmm. he was for very long terms of office compared to what. And one of the reasons for that is that you need an institutional memory inside the body. And each person needs to be able to have a memory. So if you're, and again, you're in a 3-mile-an-hour society here. So mm-hmm. if it takes you a month to travel to your office or, you know, to D.C. to assume office or even a couple of weeks, and then you spend a certain amount of time there, and within two years you're back in your district running for re-election, then, you know, that's a, you don't have all that much time to learn the
ropes.
No,
and even with our, certainly in House of Representatives, those guys are running, and those women are running for re-election the day that they take office. And they spend an inordinate amount of time raising money every single day, and that means it's time that they're not spending legislating, they're not spending governing. What else do you want to tell us about Madison?
Well, I mean, I've sort of dealt with some of the things that I was going to talk about in the other areas. But one of the things that's most interesting about Madison's conception of human nature, I think, is a kind of psychological dynamic that he fastens on to when a multiplicity of people act together. In group actions, he is worried fundamentally about group irrationality.
Mob rule.
He is definitely worried about that phenomena. And he says that individuals will do actions in a group which they would find absolutely offensive to themselves in their closet. Their closet is their study. It's not the place they hang their mm-hmm. clothes. It's their study. So alone in your closet, you would say that's wrong, but you can be kindled by a flame of enthusiasm in a group mm-hmm. and led to do something that you would not do. So one of the purposes, I argue, is to, in effect, by creating a huge geographical area, you disconnect the possibility initially that a majority will form in the first place based upon, kind of inflamed passions. So in the 10th Federalist, Madison says that a faction may flame up in one area of the country, but its ability to spread across the whole nation will not be able to do that, or it will be checked mostly by the other multiplicity of groups inside the nation. But Madison believes that this dynamic inverts as well. And what's interesting about this is that people have looked at dialogue and conversations among groups, and they've seen this phenomena. And it's known in, I think, in sociology and in rhetoric as the spiral of silence. So as much as you will be brought out to do actions that are immoral or that you would find revolting when you're acting in a group, you can also be disinclined to do the right thing if you're opposed by a large majority of people who disagree with you. You can spiral back into silence as a result of that. So he had a very sophisticated understanding of the dynamics of group action, and he applies this to legislative bodies in general. In much the same way as you want the right size state, you want the right size republic, you also want the right size legislative body. You want a legislative body that has exactly the right number. This is no science, trust mm-hmm. me, but you have the right number of people in it so that you don't promote the passions of the multitude inside that body, and you also don't have too few people to get all of the interest their fair say.
Which brings up another current issue, but not perhaps in the headlines, but we have had the same size Congress, I think, since when? The 1920s? 1930? Yes. Something of that sort? Yes. 435 people in the Congress, in the House of Representatives, and an extra 100 in the Senate. So 535 people, and it's been that way as our population has increased dramatically in the last few decades. I wonder what Madison would have thought about that size issue in our legislature.
One of the amendments that he proposes as a part of the Bill of Rights, there are actually several so-called structural amendments as well, but two in particular do not pass. We can talk about the 27th Amendment in a few minutes. That's the one that prevents representatives from giving themselves their own pay raise, and it fits in with our earlier conversation. Mm-hmm. But there's also one that's going to gradually increase the number of representatives as the population, in correspondence with population, increases. But of course, even Madison's scheme for that, it limits the number eventually of representatives there will be. And what we now have is a phenomenon that you've talked about, which is we froze the number of representatives at 435.
And that was done by statute. It was not, right. It's not constitutional.
That's exactly right. Their constitution says nothing about the total number of representatives we have in it. And once that took place, as population grew, we went, we gradually worked our way up. Now, if I remember correctly, it's something like 740,000 people for each representative district.
Yeah.
And it's projected to be by 2050 or maybe even before then to be one representative for every million people. So when we get to 435 million people in the United States, mm-hmm. we will have electoral districts that each have approximately a million people in them. Mm-hmm. And, that's through the Supreme Court rulings, you basically have to have the same number of individuals in each electoral district after the famous reapportionment district court cases that came, Westbury versus Sanders mm-hmm. and the other cases that are surrounding that. And so you have, when we get to that point, it's going to be interesting to see whether Americans say, well, maybe we need a larger legislative body than we currently have. It's kind of hard, for the same reasons we talked about earlier, to sell the idea of more representatives in the body to the American people. And there are Madisonian reasons also for not doing that. Like I talked about, if it's too large a body, then it can become passion. He's worried about that. But other nations work with more representatives than we currently have. And we've got to, at some point, address the problem that, every American is now going to be 1/1,000,000th of a share of getting that share of representation. We're going to have to come to terms with that.
Yeah. And as you say, there's great resistance to it. There's such an anti-government feeling out there, and that's been growing, I think, for the last 30 or so years. That any time you would even float such a proposal, I imagine people would say that's the last thing we need is more of those filthy politicians.
This is, I think, that myth is one of the things I think is the most potent misunderstanding that contemporary Americans have, or rather that they've been sold about the American founding. If I could extract from the American consciousness something that they're supposedly taught about their founding fathers that is not true, it is that they believed that government was essentially unnecessary, that it was always corruptible. There's some things that you can quote from Thomas Jefferson, but there are a number of other things from Jefferson you can quote to the contrary. He's good on both sides of almost every debate.
Yes, he is. Well, what I've always noticed, Alan, is that many people who are the most anti-government will quote from the revolutionary period.
That's right. That's right.
Okay, and they were criticizing King George and his right. parliament. Right. It's completely different when you're talking about your own government that's composed of your own people. And indeed, people will, on the one hand, revere the Constitution, or at least what their conception is, and on the other hand, hate the government that the Constitution creates. There's quite a contrast, isn't there?
So just to build on that, the same group of people who fought the American Revolution essentially invested the new government with most of the powers they denied to the king mm-hmm. and to Parliament. So you can't impose taxes on us unless you give us representation. Well, once we form a representative system, then it's okay to tax.
Exactly. This virulent, almost reflexive hatred of taxes. Well, I understand that. I don't like paying taxes either. Nobody does. But the idea of taxation, well, you have to have taxes.
Right.
And as long as you've got representation, then you've addressed the revolutionary issue. And in fact, I seem to recall, now you're the historian, correct me, that when the Whiskey Rebellion broke out, and they were, of course, objecting to the excise tax on whiskey, and they were using some of that revolutionary rhetoric. I think it was George Washington who said, that doesn't apply anymore. I mean, this is your own government that has voted these in, and you have a voice in this, and that's the law.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that you've captured the dynamic properly there. You know, once we set up a government, it was a much more powerful government than many people had envisioned that took office. It was still a limited government. It was still a government of limited powers and enumerated powers. And some of the people who are making points about government tyranny as the primary thing we should guard against are suggesting post-New Deal that we have illegitimately expanded those powers using parts of the Constitution and loose readings of the Constitution. So they do have a point when they talk it in that way. A simple prohibition against government exercising power does not resonate back to the American constitutional period, the period of creating the United States Constitution.
Right. Well, we're getting a little short on time, and you keep hinting about that 27th Amendment. So let's talk about that. Was that part of the original Bill of Rights?
It was. So Madison proposed, eventually the first Congress, rather, took Madison's proposals, went them down to 12 different proposals. Mm-hmm. Actually, the first two were the ones that were not accepted, mm-hmm. and then the numbers 3 through 12 became the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, which you now call the Bill of Rights. We didn't apparently call them the Bill of Rights until very late in American history than you would think about, mm-hmm. and that evolved over time. At any rate, of those two, one was this kind of regulation of the number of representatives to keep pace with population growth, and another was a prohibition against representatives increasing their own pay. That didn't mean they couldn't vote a pay increase. It simply meant that they had to vote it forward for a future Congress. They couldn't vote one for themselves immediately, okay?
Right, so if I'm a member of Congress, I can legislate regarding pay, just like I can legislate regarding a host of other issues, but I can't do it today. I can't say today I'm going to raise my salary. I can vote in the future to do it, but if I recall correctly, it says there has to be at least one election between then and now.
The key is the intervening election.
Right.
That's exactly right.
So I have to go back to my own people and explain why I just raised my own pay.
So turns out what the ethical principle behind that is that you shouldn't be a judge in your own cause. The representatives should not be judges voting themselves pay raises in their own cause. That's, again, the underlying stipulation here. And, you know, we have adopted the 27th Amendment. Took place in the 1980s, if I remember correctly, something like that. It's the latest amendment to the Constitution that's been ratified. It was ratified
1992. Oh, yeah,
92. It was 92. Right. Okay.
It's kind of funny. There's a whole story there, and I keep trying to get the fellow who's behind the story on the show. And one of these
Gregory
days,
Watson. Grandma,
he was the guy who figured it out. It was still out there. That this proposal was still out there, and he said, we should get it ratified.
So he's working in the Texas state legislature at this time period.
If you know him, I want you to call him up for me because I have left him messages. And
have you really?
Yes, I have.
Well, that's interesting because he's done a couple of interviews since that's taken place.
Right.
I'm surprised he won't respond to you.
Well, maybe I left the wrong voicemail mailbox or something.
It's actually a much more complex story in some ways than people think, mm-hmm. because he favored this reigniting of Madison's amendment so that there would be a flat prohibition against any kind of pay increase for congressmen. But what Congress can do, according to constitutional rulings, is that they can set in place pay increases to take place over be mandatory or automatic to take place over time, and that does not violate the 27th Amendment, according to the Supreme Court.
Hmm.
Watson thinks that was itself a misreading of Madison's intentions. He wanted voters to have to approve of any kind of pay raise that took place, even if it was a mere cost of living increase.
Mm-hmm.
So Congress regularly gets cost of living increases unless it votes not to take them. And that has been a standard for a while, is my understanding. I've written something on this, and the facts are somewhat fuzzy now. But they went on for a while to not vote themselves these cost of living increases because Congress as a body was so unpopular. And if they anybody found out they were getting a dime more than they currently got, then that was creating a problem. So basically, they tried to backdoor this to include it as automatic pay increases. Mm-hmm. So that people didn't know about them taking place. And, you know, so it's possible for Congress to get cost of living adjustments, but they can't vote themselves.
Well, the argument would be that all that's doing is keeping the actual value, the real value of their money at more or less the same place. You can make an argument on either side of a COLA, of a cost of living increase. Well, very interesting. We are getting very short here now, Alan. So is there anything else you wanted to add before we finish up our discussion of Madison's character and how it affected his theory of governance?
No, I mean, I think James Madison is obviously, I didn't choose to study him for no reason. I think he's one of the most admirable of an admirable group of men who are under a great deal of fire now. These are very, very complex moral questions that we're asking now in American society about slaveholders being heroes.
Yeah.
And, you know, so
I'm going to put in a plug for Montpelier there. We have an exhibit here now called The Mere Distinction of Color. And it faces that issue head on. And Montpelier faces that issue head on. And the David Rubenstein gift is being used to reconstruct slave quarters and to bring that narrative front and center. So it's we're not ignoring that issue. This not maybe our focus today. We're not ignoring that issue, but there are lots of other good things that Madison did, as well as a lot of the other founders.
If you look at slavery only, or if you believe that slaveholding completely discredits a person, then it's very difficult to give any credit to these men. If you spread out your judgment in a more complex way, and you also understand the conditions under which slavery was already present when they took, you know, when they grew up, when they inherited their plantations, those kinds of, if you make those kinds of calculations, it becomes a more difficult moral decision. I won't tell you that that it can ever be an easy question to answer. I mean, I think the judgments that are made against some of them are improper, but I also think that being a slaveholder required a certain degree of actions that none of us would want to be a part of. But it is the institution itself, in a sense, that is to be blamed.
Don't historians have a term for it? Don't you call it presentism when we take our current moral structure and impose it upon people from the past?
Sure. But I know you're not trying to do this either. I'm not trying to apologize for slaveholders. It's an exquisitely complex moral calculation that you have to do. If we bracket slavery for a minute, I just want to say one other thing, and that Madison was a wealthy man also. Wealthy in part because of his slaves, or in large part because of his slaves. But there is a tendency among a certain stripe of progressives. I'm a progressive. I know you said it's a nonpartisan show, but I need to state that straight out if they can get it along the way. But there's a tendency to say that everyone who is rich is corrupt by a certain subset of the left, okay? Mm-hmm. I think it's possible to be a socially responsible wealthy person in a society, mm-hmm. to have earned your wealth. I'm not talking about Madison here, but in our society, to have earned your wealth and to have every reason to responsibly then arbitrate the distribution of your wealth in ways that you see is constructive to society.
Oh, I agree with you completely. In fact, I've often commented that I think I'd make an extremely good rich person. I would always do the right thing. And so if anyone wants to give me a large sum of money, I can promise you it would be well spent. Well, Alan Gibson, thank you so very much for taking the time with us today. We appreciate your insights in James Madison.
Thank you very much. It was fun. It was really fun.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Alan Gibson of California State University at Chico. One of the nicest guys I've had in the booth for a long time. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.